What's up, everyone? This week on the pod, Ben Edge and I interview Kira from Black Flag. Stay tuned for that. Please support the podcast by subscribing to it wherever you listen to it. Also, please find the time to like it, rate it, and review it. If you want to go the extra mile, you can go to patreon.com/185milesouth and become a monthly Patreon. $1 gets you behind the paywall, and we do bonus episodes for every interview podcast. So I have a few buddies on. We talk about that podcast as well as the playlist associated with it. Speaking of the playlist, you can go to 185milesouth.com and there is a playlist for every episode. Click that playlist link and check it out. And let's get on with the pod.
"185 Miles South", a hardcore punk rock podcast.
What's up, everyone? This week on the pod, we have Kira. And you would probably know her most from Black Flag, but we know her from Black Flag Dose and is an Emmy award-winning dialogue editor. What's up, Kira?
Hey.
Thanks so much for taking the time. Much appreciated.
No problem.
How did you get into punk and hardcore?
I have a older brother who actually went to high school with a guy named Paul Beam, who eventually was the lead singer of a band called The Germs in LA. Darby Crash was his punk rock name. And so my brother and I went to see them at the Whiskey really early, you know, 76, 77, something like that. And started going to shows and started our own bands starting way back then. So it was just, it was twofold. It was that we knew people and we started to, you know, connect with the energy of it, but also we were both players, you know, we played music. So we wanted to meet other people who played music and, you know, join bands and have bands and stuff. So, you know, before that, this whole arena rock thing was how you saw a lot of bands, you know, so it was not very appealing in terms of trying to break in to getting to actually, you know, play with people. But suddenly there was this much smaller, much more accessible way to see bands and potentially play with them.
A follow-up question, Kira, about your brother, Paul. So tell me about how he ends up playing in bands, because he's known for a couple bands that he maybe two or three or four bands that he ended up being in. Screamers, I imagine being.
Ben blew up, but he mentioned the Screamers.
Yeah. So my brother, actually, I believe it was me who introduced him to the drummer of the Screamers, KK, who I saw at the Mask, you know, which is this early sort of punk rock club. And he told me they were looking for a keyboard player. And since it was like the only keyboard band and my brother was a keyboard player, I was pretty interested in pursuing that, because Paul had been basically playing drums in the bands, you know, that me and this guitar player have been doing. So he hadn't really gotten to shine the way he might doing, you know, his keyboards thing. So, but anyway, it was the same kind of thing, as like you get to meet people at shows and you connect and you, you get to join bands. And I used to go a lot of times to like sound checks and just help bands move their gear and stuff, because A, I couldn't afford to go to shows and I was hoping to get on their guest list, but also you can meet people and talk to people and maybe, you know, have the possibility if there's a slot or a person who's looking to start a band or whatever, you have the possibility of making those connections.
Yeah, Kira, most people that I've had on this podcast, they come around in the 80s, but since you were there for like those early days, can you kind of describe what the mask was like and what going to shows there was like?
Well, it was really small for one thing. Like people don't realize how small punk rock was like the whole time, really. Like now it's really big and hip, but you know, it was super underground. So dressing that way, looking that way, you know, was really kind of frowned upon. You got a lot of dirty looks, and you know, the mask would, you know, 100 people was a huge show there. Now the mask was also a practice place. They had, it had a bunch, it was like a bunch of little crappy rooms. It was this cement basement basically under the Pussycat Theater, but there was a bunch of little rooms, and this guy was renting out rooms to bands both monthly and hourly. Eventually I actually worked there for him in exchange for free practice time for my band. I would stay, come there after school and kind of let bands in and out and take the money if they owed, you know, hourly rate or whatever. And in exchange, he would bring me lunch. And because we were always starving, and he would give me free practice time. So but it was a practice place by day, and then at night, you know, there were some shows. It would get constantly shut down by the fire marshal. So, and you know, you had the same problem there and at other clubs around town. They'd have some punk rock shows, and then it'd be like, okay, no more punk rock, because they'd decide that some damage had happened or whatever, which, you know, was or wasn't true depending on the situation. But so it was a very fleeting thing to be able to, you know, book your band in Los Angeles. But at first, you know, Hollywood had the mask and had maybe a couple of other clubs here and there. There were also some halls that occasionally someone would rent a hall and do a big show. And then, you know, sometimes in the valley, here in the San Fernando Valley, or once in a while down in the South Bay, there would start to be a little bit of activity. You know, where Black Flag started down in the South Bay, there weren't a lot of gigs there. They would come up early in their days to play in Hollywood and stuff, but that's not where they were from, you know. So it was very hit and miss to be able to get a show to happen without getting shut down. And or without just having nowhere to play, you know.
Yeah, Kira, did you go to shows also at the Fleetwood and the Cuckoo's Nest? And if so, how were those different than like the scene at the Mask?
Well, so that was a little bit later, but Cuckoo's Nest was pretty early, and it would I played there actually a couple times with my brother's band, Twisted Roots, and. It was, Cuckoo's Nest was not as extreme of a South Bay club as the Fleetwood. The Fleetwood was just, you know, ridiculously violent and unpleasant to go to, as far as I was concerned, because it was too easy. I mean, I'm just a small woman, you know. It's not You just couldn't go there and watch the band. You know, you'd have to get shoved out of the main part of the pit because people thought what punk rock was to beat each other senseless. But this was kind of later. All of that sort of slamming stuff came later. At first, it was like pogoing, and we're all like, it wasn't that it was so sweet and kind, but it was. A sort of after effect that people thought it was very violent and that the purpose of what you did in the mosh pit was, you know, moshing and slamming. All that was kind of late, you know, several years after things had started, you know, and things started in a very close-knit kind of everybody looking out for each other kind of way. So I did not want to go to the Fleetwood. It was just one of those places. Plus, you know, when I was pretty young, I didn't own my own car. So the gigs down south, you know, I would have had to get rides to and stuff. And I went to school the whole time we're talking as well. So, you know, it wasn't always it's not that I didn't plenty of time stay out late drinking, going to a punk rock show and then go to high school in the morning. But if I went to the South Bay, that was going to be a lot more difficult challenge.
Do you think so you were a roadie for the Germs at one point?
Not formally, no, but I would. I knew them and I would show up early and I would be on the side of the stage trying to keep them plugged in. And, you know, it was nothing formal. I certainly wasn't paid for it, for example, but I was often at the side of the stage and, you know, I was a familiar face. So, you know, I was somewhat accepted as a part of the, you know, a pretty small circle.
So what, tell us a little bit about what Darby Crash was like as a person.
Super intelligent. And because of that, I think a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of a wall between him and most of the world. It was a little hard to break through the wall. And he, you know, he cared about the people who he was closest to, but he had a hard time connecting with, you know, the masses, if you will. Not that they were really masses, but just really intelligent, like writing amazing poetry. You know, his lyrics are just so sort of cerebral, you know, and in a group of people like that, there were not that many people really coming across that way, you know. And he just, I think because of that, he also struggled with, you know, depression and addiction, as many people did. But, you know, I don't know. There were certainly, secretively, there were certainly people betting on who would die, you know, young. And I don't think I would have picked him.
You mean you thought he might have lived a little longer?
Yeah, I do. Although he really struggled with addiction and with, you know, not wanting to face the world clean and sober, he was just so brilliant, you know, and you don't often think of someone like that who can't, you know, work their way past their 20s, you know.
Right. Do you think, like when you think of the Germs, and then we were talking about the Mask scene and then we were talking about the Fleetwood scene, and I know the Germs kind of bridged those two scenes, like they played both those clubs. Do you think there was kind of a middle stage between the Mask punk thing happening and then the kind of South Bay, Orange County hardcore thing that was happening? Like, was there like a middle step between those two things, or did it just go from one to the other seamlessly?
I mean, come on, the Germs may have played the Fleetwood once or twice, but they certainly, I mean, they were no more a Fleetwood band than they were a Hollywood band. You know, I think that, again, you have to remember that at the time, just being able to play a show was tricky. So if you could play the Fleetwood, you would play the Fleetwood. If you could play the Cuckoo's Nest, you would, you know what I mean? It's like there weren't so many gigs to be had, you know, but it wasn't, no, there weren't bridges, and it wasn't particularly calculated. I always think it's weird when people talk about like hardcore and what's punk rock. It's like at the time we weren't labeling ourselves like that, you know.
Yeah,
this is all afterwards, trying to explain something and categorize something that was a little bit more organic than that, you know.
Right, that makes sense. So tell us a little bit about Twisted Roots, because Twisted Roots doesn't get talked about a lot, and I know they're like, I don't know if they were if you guys were considered like a super group when you first came out. But if you think about it, it's like the guy from the Screamers, your brother, Pat Smear, just after the Germs break up. And Darby's still alive at this point, right?
Yes. No, because remember, I had not been in any big bands at that time. And the Screamers, although they were pretty big for L.A., they didn't really tour, and they, you know, and they traveled a little bit. They went up north a little, and they went to the East Coast once, you know, I mean, and they didn't record any records. So in the big scheme of things, the Screamers were not, they were big in LA, like big means you could fill the Whiskey a Go-Go, you know, we could maybe get 500 people in one of the biggest cities in the country. Right.
Right.
So the perspective is that, yeah, super group, you know, yeah, eventually Pat is in a big band, but it isn't the Germs, right?
Yeah.
So, Twisted Roots was was my brother's band, right? He wrote the songs. It had a little bit of a pop, if you want to categorize again, kind of sensibility song-wise, a little bit. But his, he handpicked me because I was his sister. But Pat, again, we go way back with Pat. He went to high school with Pat, you know, so that was not a difficult choice to reach to him for a guitar player. Maggie, I went to high school with, and was in 12th grade with, so I introduced Maggie to Paul, and she wanted to be a singer, and her boyfriend Emil was the drummer. So it was, you know, a pretty close circle that originally got put together. Interestingly, also the guy who decided to manage Twisted Roots, and we did have a manager, was this young kid who, you know, believed in himself enough to say, you know, I can do this. He got us headlining gigs at the Whiskey, which was pretty incredible, and eventually started Golden Voice, which is this huge company that still survives to this day, you know, a promotion, you know, putting on shows and stuff. So Paul just pulled together people from his life who were a good fit. And Twisted Roots had several incarnations. That was just the first.
What was the Golden Voice guy's name?
Rick Van Santen. Okay. He's no longer with us, but he was at the beginning of Golden Voice Promotions, which eventually, you know, put on all the shows, basically.
Right.
That's a great name. It just sounds like someone that's going to be successful. Rick yeah. Van Santen. It's awesome.
He was an amazing guy.
Kira, did you get to see Black Flag with all four? Obviously, you saw him with Henry, and you saw him with someone before, because I read that they were your favorite band before you joined. But were you able to?
That time I saw them was with Henry when they were a five piece. They came back from tour with Henry, with Dez on guitar, and with Biscuits on drums. But I saw them with Ron. I saw them with Keith. I saw them with Dez. Yeah, I mean, they were one of those bands that you tried to go to see, and they played pretty regularly. So although I didn't like going to the Fleetwood, they came up, they did a lot of shows, and I tried to see them as much as possible.
Do you have an opinion on who was the best singer, or is that unfair to ask?
Well, I mean, do I have an opinion? Not really. I, of course, think Henry was incredible. I think that he had the strongest voice in some ways. Like, he put the most sheer muscle, if you will, behind his singing, which mattered to me, like the actual anger and fury that he could put behind it. I probably would have thought that Keith did something similar. I saw Flag went at their very first gig and thought he definitely still had an element of that thing that I'm talking about. But I mean, all of them, it's like all the incarnations. I mean, Chuck's amazing. So, you know, to say, you know, what's the best bass player? You know, it's like, I think we both brought different things to Black Flag, but, you know, I don't have any perspective on myself. So therefore Chuck would be my favorite probably, you know. He was amazing, and he wrote some of the best songs Black Flag ever did.
Yeah. Actually wanted to ask you about just before you joined Black Flag, they kind of switch gears a little bit and start playing these really long, slow songs, like the B-side of My War, for example. And I'm just wondering if you think there was a statement they were trying to make but with that, or if they were just literally playing the music they felt like playing and that's that, and there's nothing more to it.
I think that they didn't play a whole bunch. There were three long, slow songs, by the way. It was just those three. So, you know, in the scheme of things, I don't even think it was that big of a thing. Yes, there was a shift. I think that there was a interest in... when you play, you know, some of the stuff, when you listen to or play some of the early stuff, it's very high energy, very fast, right? But it's almost like Bill wants to explain this to me, the drummer, Bill Stevenson, is like, you can play, you know, you take a hammer and you try to hammer really fast, right? In order to put hammer really fast, you have to hit less hard.
Right.
And if you want to hit really hard, you have to slow down. Right?
Right.
So almost like experimenting with this idea of, we were constantly, you know, by the time I was coming in, like how to play every single note in a very, very hard way. And because of that, you know, at times pace is affected. Now, by the time you've been playing these songs on tour for a month, it starts to get pretty fast as well, sometimes, right, at least for most of the songs. But I think that it was more to do with the heaviness factor that maybe at times felt lost when you played all of the songs at this sort of, you know, kind of pace, and try to find some moments of heaviness by slowing it down. I think it had more to do with that. I think that if you listen to a song like My War, it's not as fast of a song as the songs from earlier records, but it's the intensity of it and the heaviness of it, you know, people didn't react to that the way they did to side two, even though it's still a song that represents this shift that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that it seems purposeful just because you know, you do have those three longer songs on side B, and Black Flag has looked at a band that does everything with like such precision and purpose. So it does seem like there is a shift there that was intentional.
Well, I mean, you could say the same thing, that it was tied into Chuck not being in the band anymore.
Fair. Yeah. And that's yes. why we have you to straighten it out, Kira.
Well, I'm saying, yeah, there's shifting happening. I'm not denying it. I'm just saying, question yourself as to what shift is causing what. And it isn't simply I've got these three long, slow songs. It is a shift that involves, you know, a more seismic underneath the cover and pervasive shift rather than simply let's play some long, slow songs. That's all.
Yeah. And actually, I wanted to ask you about that. I think of Black Flag, the early years, as being Greg and Chuck as kind of co-captains of the ship. And Chuck leaves in 83. I'm just wondering what caused him to leave the band.
I don't know. I wasn't there, but okay. I will say this. My perspective was always that it was somewhat Greg's band. It was mostly Greg's songs. And so I would question the premise. Chuck always had a huge influence. And by the way, after I joined, Chuck was managing and booking. So he did not exit stage left, never to be heard again. Right.
So
it is, again, it's a shift, but it's not, I don't think it's completely just, Chuck was, you know, knee deep and completely in, and then he stepped out. I think that he may have not gotten to have the effect maybe that he wanted to, you know, maybe it's because of exactly that premise that you're talking about. He should have been a partner, but Greg couldn't let him be. I don't know. You know, it's as likely that as anything else, in the sense that he certainly had earned over the years and with his contribution to be a partner. But I'm not sure that's how I would suggest that Greg works.
Right.
Well, we can jump right to when you know what's going on. Kira, how did you join Black Flag?
So like I said, they were my favorite band, and I did briefly date Henry, briefly. And I get a call from him in 1983, fall of 1983. I'm playing with Dez in a band called DC3. And I've just joined them like 3 months before. And we're practicing literally in Black Flag's practice place, right? And so I get a call from Henry going, you know, do you want to try to play, you know, maybe play with Greg and Bill? Chuck's going to be out of the band, and there's not going to be anything between us, though. I'm like, yeah, I get it. So, you know, just stay after practice, you know, because I was DC3 was practicing before Black Flag practice, right? So it was going to be easy enough for me to just stay and jam with them. Interestingly, when that happened, Greg and Bill didn't seem to know anything about that. Or at least that was the feeling I got, was that when I said, hey, do you guys want to jam now? They were surprised or hadn't really known or something. But we did. We jammed. We jammed on some of the riffs that eventually became part of some instrumental songs on later records. And at the end of that jam, they asked me if I would join. I said I was going to UCLA, that I wanted to finish. I was 3 years into a 4-year degree, but that I was willing to take quarters off to tour and stuff, but I did want to complete my studies, and they agreed. So it was basically completed in that night.
And what was your, what were you thinking at that point? Like, oh my God, I'm in Black Flag now. Like, was there ever a moment where you're just like, this can't be actually happening? Or was it more casual than that?
No, it was definitely like, I was, I mean, you get a combination of emotions. I was nervous because I knew having, you know, been around Henry and them enough, I knew the commitment that I was talking about, you know, that it wasn't as simple as just any old band I was joining. And I was excited because they were one of my favorite, if not my favorite bands right at that time. So I pretty quickly, I think right then and there, decided I was going to get a Black Flag tattoo. I went and got one. When Henry got one on the back of his neck, I got mine on my arm at the same time. We went together and did that. So that was kind of I almost had gotten one before. I sure as hell I'm going to get one now, you know.
Do you have a germs burn?
No. Never had a germs burn. I considered at one time getting a tattoo of a blue circle, but I never had a germs burn. I never let them come near me with the cigarette. I always thought that was kind of silly. I mean, I got it because, I mean, my brother back in high school, Darby, the band Paul, had this like cult like following, you know, so they had that kind of effect on people, but I am just not really that much of a follower. I'm a little bit of a nonconformist, so when everybody starts doing something, my brakes go on.
Right, that's punk, you know, it's being against the grain. Tell me about the first show you ever played with Black Flag. Tell me if I got this right. It happened in Torrance on December 29th, 1983. Does that sound right?
December?
Yeah, December. Did it happen before that?
No, it could be. It was a party in a garage.
I think I just got this from maybe I got it from Get in the Van, where they have the show list on in the back of the book.
Yeah, I could be. It was definitely in 1983. I thought it might be a little early. Look, my memory's terrible. I thought it might be a little earlier just because by spring we're on tour. And we recorded Slip It In and Family Man, I think, before that tour. So it was a busy few months, wasn't it?
Wow. And so was there, this might have been a different show, but something like crazy happened to you, like you were attacked in a bathroom?
Only a couple times. Which one did you hear about? No. There was one that was later. There was one when we played an instrumental show in Long Beach, but that was, we were playing basically like a more of a process of weeding out gig. So it would have been farther into 1984, and I was attacked in Long Beach bathroom. And yeah, my head smashed against the floor and they grabbed my right hand and bent it back. And my right hand always really hurt. So it was bad. And it was 10 minutes before we went on, but I played anyway, yada, yada, yada. I'm so tired.
Who did it? Like, who did this to you?
It was an inside job. You know, let's just say that.
Do you think you could take her in a rematch now?
Well, she got someone to do it. It wasn't her herself. Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't take her on.
Yeah.
I could take the person who got her to do it on.
Well, that's fair.
And Bill and Henry chased after her and would have been sorry. She would have been sorry if they had caught her, because that they were, you know. I mean, that's one thing. I mean, one of the cool things about Black Flag was that it was treated somewhat as a professional thing. So, we did a threat from outside was treated, you know, as just that. And we had each other's backs, and I always felt that they'd have mine. It's disappointing when you find out that there were elements of it that was an inside job. But at the moment, they chased after her, and I know it would not have gone well for her if they had caught her, because nobody knew what had happened and why right then in that moment.
Kira, people are going to kill me if I don't follow up on this and say, who was it that set it up? And you're okay to say, I'm not telling you.
There was this really bad misunderstanding, and it was not related to any individual that was actually in the group, but rather a peripheral person who's really, you know, gone off into obscurity now. But, there was just a misunderstanding. I still don't know for sure what motivated, like, whether this person eventually was confronted and had a story. And I just am not sure whether the story was even just a bunch of bullshit or for real. Do you know what I mean? And that's part of what makes me reticent to say, because I don't know whether I just didn't get fed a bunch of bullshit in order to try to smooth things over, or whether it was just the big misunderstanding that was claimed to be. So I know that's kind of chicken, but
no, that's fair. What are your memories of your first time touring with Black Flag?
So the My War Tour, which was the record we were touring on in the spring of 1984, was the first tour. And we started out from Torrance area, South Bay, with a half school bus vehicle that was, you know, converted into tour van, and drove out of Los Angeles. And gosh, we probably made it, you know, 600 miles, and that thing broke down and burned up, and we all tumbled out of it. It didn't really like fully burn, but everyone thought it was burning, and they left me in the shelf, which was high up and difficult to get out of. But we then didn't have a vehicle. So Chuck had to take his van and grab us and drive us to Oklahoma City to our next gig. And we rode basically in Chuck's van from all of the rest of the tour, which was when we had planned to have this much more spacious vehicle, to have a van with all of our gear and basically be, you know, riding on top of it with us and our road crew and everything. It was pretty tight quarters. We never again had quite that tight of a setup. So that was one thing. It's just a little, my first experience was, oh God, what have I got myself into? Cause it was really like the drives were really difficult. And then the gigs, I was having a lot of trouble, like I said, with my right hand. So, you know, every gig I'd just be, you know, holding my hand, we'd come off the stage and I'd be holding my hand and waiting. And if we had to play an encore, you know, play the encore. And then as soon as the encore is over, I'm like sticking my hand in an ice bucket, basically. And you know, a lot of pain and trying to adjust to the physicality of it. So there's that sort of reality, the drives, the physical pain of playing gigs. I was also having trouble with gear, speakers blowing out. You know, it's just a lot of trying to get accustomed to something that, you know, was so out of the sphere. You think, you know, I've played a bunch of gigs by now. You know, I've been playing since I was 16. I'm 23 now. You know, I've been playing gigs the whole time, but it's not like it was before, you know. Right. So I keep facing these new realities of difficulty. And then, you know, and just and the joy of the, you know, 1 or 2 hours of being on stage and then the misery of the other 22 hours, you know, basically.
Do you think being so stacked on top of each other in the van like that, did that bring you closer together or did it make it more of a combustible situation?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, there's a lot of just professionalism in terms of this is just, you know, what we had to deal with at the time. And yeah, over the course of a couple of years, it gets, you know, stuff can start to wear, but we did eventually get different arrangements. I mean, by the couple of tours from there, by the fall tour, we were traveling with a Ryder truck with the PA system, and Henry and the road crew would be in that. So that was offloading not only people, but all the gear. So now we're in a van basically with just people and maybe some clothes bags, you know. So it didn't stay that way in terms of being, you know, right on top of each other and uncomfortable and stuff. It has as much to do with how little sleep you're getting if the way the school, the tour is scheduled is you have a, you know, 600 mile drive and you can't go to sleep because you have to just pack up and drive after the gig to get to the next gig, you know?
Right.
You know, so there's sleeplessness is certainly has as much effect on, you know, people all being warm and fuzzy with each other as anything else.
Yeah, it seems like Black Flag was on a mission. There's just so much touring and so many records coming out that like there was, it almost seems like there was this overall goal of the band, although I don't know what that goal would be, to be the best, the biggest, the baddest, the hardest working. What was the vibe you got?
Okay. So even before I joined, there was this, you know, there was a hardworking element to it for sure. What happened record wise though, is there had been an injunction against the name Black Flag for 2 years because of Unicorn Records. And they finally got out from under that. So record wise, we put out 7 records in the course of the 2 years I was in the band just because we finally could start putting records out, you know, and then you want a tour to support those records too. And basically if you're not touring and selling merchandise, you're not selling records and you're not making any money. It's not like we have any other income generating here. We're a bunch of people, you know, trying to just keep like basically an office space with a practice pad going, but you know, people were living on, you know, in Henry's living in the Ginn's shed and I'm living on people's couches and you know what I mean? It's like, we don't have any money. So there's a strong motivation also to be out, you know, trying to at least break even. Oh yeah. By the way, to get out from under that injunction, we had $100,000 worth of legal bills to pay because we had to have a lawyer work in court to get out from under that injunction. So, you know, there were motivations.
And that injunction related to Unicorn Records putting out the Black Flag Damaged record?
Right, it was a 2-record contract and then Unicorn basically didn't pay Black Flag for the first record. So they refused to do the second record. So they put an injunction on the name Black Flag.
Oh, okay. And then Black Flag ended up putting out a record anyway. And then that was
They didn't. They just had to get the injunction lifted, which took, you know, a huge amount of legal battle to just prove that Unicorn Records had been in breach of contract and not the other way around. Black Flag wasn't in breach of contract for not making a record because Unicorn hadn't paid them for the first one.
Right. What a nightmare. So you co-wrote a handful of songs when you were in Black Flag. What was that like bringing songs that you wrote to the band? How did that work? I have a list of songs and maybe it's not a complete list, but we'll get to that. What was it like writing songs for Black Flag?
I really didn't. I mean, I'm given credit for the jams that we did together, but those were literally jams we did in practice. There's only two songs that I actually brought to Black Flag that had been Sexic songs, which was my all-girl band, and Henry wrote lyrics to the music of those two songs.
And those became what, as Black Flag songs, what were the names of those ones?
Best One Yet was one of them.
I'm the One, maybe?
I'm the One.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's another one, Out of This World. Do you remember that one?
I thought that was Boo. Could have been my music. It was Bill wrote the lyrics to one of these.
Okay.
I
really like that song.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Sorry. I don't mean to minimize it. It's just that, you know, a lot has happened since then.
Understood.
Yeah. Kira, you're remembering a lot. So
I'm just saying, like, in my life, I'm going to be 60 this year, okay? And Black Flag was like 2.25 years. So put it in perspective.
It's
an important period, and I have no regrets, and I'm not down on talking about it. But it is sometimes difficult to focus on the nitty-gritty details sometimes.
Yeah. No, I know, but that's what Ben is here for. So we appreciate him for that. What was the recording process like recording with Black Flag compared to the previous bands that you recorded with?
Oh God. So with Black Flag, what we did, and I had done this once before, I think, but we weren't trying to do the same thing. So in every time we were trying to do it, we had two records to record, and we would do a 48-hour lockout to do basic tracks on two full records.
Jesus.
So basically in a 48-hour lockout, you just play until you drop, and then you get up and you play until you drop. And it's like that until the 48 hours is over and you have to somehow have gotten through all the material. Right. And then Greg would do, Greg and Henry would do overdubs, and then mixing would happen. And during this whole time, of course, we're not on tour. So what's happening with my life? I'm at UCLA.
Oh my God.
So I'm inevitably have midterms or finals happening at the same time as the 48-hour lockout.
Wow.
So I'm studying when I can't move my hand anymore. It was a very intense time for me. I would get poured out of the van at UCLA for day one of the quarter. And it, like I said, when we would record, it would be, I would usually have studying to do. I always had studying to do. I was studying applied math. I was not studying English, you know? So and I'm not a natural math person. So it was high intensity, life happening at the same time. But the net result is, you know, you save a lot of money because, and money again, like we were talking about, was tight. So we would do, like I said, the first one was Slip It In, Family Man, all the basic tracks in 48-hour lockout. That was my first experience with them. Wow. And then went on from there, you know.
Yeah.
We did the Minute Flag. We did the process of weeding out. I can't even tell you which ones we combined, but we combined, we always combined.
Yeah. Kira, as a follow-up on the math question, can you explain algebraic K-theory? I've never understood that.
No.
No, I'm just right. Ben, go ahead.
Never even heard of that. I'm not a math person either. I wanted to ask you a question about something that you mentioned in that documentary, American Hardcore. You said that you felt a certain way about the Slip It In record cover, or maybe it was the song Slip It In, when maybe it was probably the record cover when you did that song and that album comes out and it has the nun holding the leg, the guy's leg on the cover of it. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah. Like I did this hour and a half interview with the guy and that's the minute he pulled out.
Yeah. Well, we
say it. So like in the scheme of how I feel about Black Flag, again, that is a very small moment. What happened when I saw the record cover and I was sort of like, wow, I wonder, it's weird because they got a girl in the band, but you know, now with some perspective, of course, it was a Raymond Pettibone drawing for one thing. It didn't really have that much to do with them other than it was, you know, a choice over shocking record cover. You know, it was Raymond in his inimitable fashion making his statement on life. Which I've come to greatly appreciate.
Right, right.
But, you know, like I said, I was a little disappointed when I saw American Hardcore because, you know, he's free to use whatever he chooses to. But by pulling that out, it did sort of put my whole thinking process into a very narrow perspective.
Yeah. So tell me about when Bill left the band, and then Anthony replaced him.
Mm-hmm.
Do you?
Yeah, that was awesome. 2 weeks before the tour.
Oh, Jesus.
Great. My hands would never, if they weren't destroyed already, trying to whip that boy into shape in 2 weeks. Was really brutal. Look, Bill had a lot of other things he wanted to do. And, you know, Greg has his way of handling things in the world. And I think, honestly, if Greg could have magically made it happen, I would have been gone at the same time. But he, you know, he had a tour starting in 2 weeks. So he did it that way and had, you know, put me to work getting Anthony through that tour. And I really feel like I had to, you know, carry a very heavy load. The difference between Bill and Anthony, when he started, especially, you know, that thing we were talking about with the hammer and the heaviness and everything. Well, Anthony didn't know that, didn't get that. So you're trying right. to this poor boy to, and I don't mean boy in a negative way, really. I'm just saying you're trying to teach this young man to heavy up, you know, slow down, heavy up, you know, and he would just start taking off like and I was like holding back, you know, this constant tug of war trying to, you know, keep him dug in, because, you know, energy can replace how much this hurts, right? So, and look, the drums and the bass guitar are the ones who are rocking the pain in this equation, you know.
Yeah, that's important.
So So, that transition was a really difficult one. And Anthony, you know, once the 4-month tour had gotten halfway through, he started to be a more solid guy. He's still always, to my mind, the high energy songs were, more up his alley than the heavy duty ones. But he definitely brought that energy to the table.
Kira, on stage, did you have a way to like communicate with him to like dial it back? Like, did you have like a nod, or would you like shake your bass at him?
Or like slam my bass into my amp and crush my own bass guitar?
Yeah.
There was that. I literally would start laying on the back of the beat like hard and play harder and harder. And that's why it hurt so much, is because you're literally trying to will it by your hand, your right hand, particularly alone, pull it back and have him hear that he's getting ahead of you. Right. People think we just follow the drummer, but it's a dangerous way to go. Bass players are the ones who have the rhythm. Sometimes, I don't mean that universally. Bill absolutely did. But sometimes, you're dealing with someone who has to, listen to you more than you listen to them. I have the bands with no drummers at all,
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that. But what was Greg's issue with you and Bill?
How many people has Greg played with?
A million.
Okay. So who's got the problem?
Hey, I just needed to know.
We all had a problem. For as far as I know, Greg had a problem with everybody to a certain extent. And I'm not trying to exaggerate that. I'm just saying, any given time, it was, Bill wanting to do other projects, or it was, with me, I'm just such a bitch. I don't know. Being a girl, there's just so many things. I'm such a slut bitch. I don't know. It's so easy. I don't get enough sleep. I got too much attention. I don't know. I remember on the 1985 tour, they said they wanted me to dress up in lace and stuff. So I dressed up more, so I got more attention. It might have been that. I don't know. All I know is that people kept, coming and going. Chuck and I had very different styles. So I sensed that there might have been an interest in changing styles, like we talked about earlier. But I love Chuck. I can't imagine it. I can't imagine it. So, we're all trying to basically read the mind of a man who just always is, got a bee in his bonnet about somebody, and thinks he can tinker it and change it and it'll get better. And then so now, 30 years later, you have people voting on who their favorite singer is. How absurd.
Yeah.
It's a great topic, though.
Because they're all so good. I mean, in my
opinion. That's why.
Yeah, like, yeah. And, okay, so he just kept tinkering and trying to make it best. And so that's where we are.
I want to talk about, you mentioned, Greg calling you names and wanting you to dress up a certain way. Like, I heard an interview recently with, the photographer Allison Braun?
Wait. I didn't say Greg wanted me to dress
up. Oh, I'm sorry. Who was it?
No. I mean, we did this photo shoot when Anthony first joined the band, and we were about to go on this 4-month tour. And it was actually, I think, Henry who said, gee, it'd be fun it'd be kind of cool if you dressed up for the whole tour. And I said, look, if I just had a couple $100, I could do it. And so they gave me the money. And me and my sister-in-law came up with a whole look, and we dyed my hair purple, and I wore heels, and I looked totally different. I went from being a tomboy to being all girly girl and in lace. It was a game, but it was not Greg's doing or anybody's particular doing. It was sort of a a game more. But I did get a lot more attention.
Right, right. Yeah, because right, I was
a photographer, Allison Braun.
Yeah. Anyway, she just talked about seeing, trying to photograph Black Flag at a show when she was 15, and one of the roadies singling her out and lunging at her and really kind of giving her a hard time physically. And I'm just wondering if there was like, if that was a common thing in the Black Flag camp, that like people were, some people were treated differently because of, you know, who they were, what, or if women were treated differently than men. If you felt any of that.
I think that early on there's a bit of that, and there certainly was a lot of like joking, you know, what we call these days locker room talk, you know. Yeah. But I would say that and there was a roadie who sort of enjoyed I didn't guess that he would actually be physical about it. I guess that he would say inappropriate things, especially now looking back, would be thought of as pretty inappropriate things. But also, when you are a young gal, that I did this too. I was a young gal at very big punk rock shows that, you know, got pretty unruly. It was easy to feel like you were being threatened by the physicality of it and the individual men. I mean, I felt unsafe a lot of times, and I could name names of men that made me feel unsafe. So if she felt like that, I certainly wouldn't question it. That it's too bad. I feel badly about that. I'd certainly, if I had seen someone specifically treating a young girl physically badly, I would have stepped in. But I'm guessing it was before I was in the band.
It was. I think it's more like 81, somewhere around there.
I'm guessing that because of that, that this roadie I'm thinking of may have been involved. And you know, he retired for good reason. And he's now a happily married man with kids, of course. Right?
Yeah.
Kira, why do you leave Black Flag?
Excuse me?
Why do you leave Black Flag, and how do you remember that coming about?
I was told to leave.
Okay. What do you remember about that conversation?
Okay. So it's literally like 2 days after the end of the 1985 tour. I come down to pick up my bass or something, some set of stuff from the office. And Chuck says he wants to talk to me, and he takes me over to this coffee shop right over there. And he says, those guys don't want to play with you anymore. And he offers me a sum of money to buy out my existence. And I say no. And I suggested a counteroffer, which he said no. And then I packed up a little more than I had been planning to take, and I left. Wow. But I knew, I mean, don't get me wrong. I knew. I was actually crying a little bit at the last gig because I knew it was my last gig. So I'm not saying I didn't know. I had known really for a couple of weeks that there was a tour being planned that was during my next and last quarter at UCLA. So I knew.
What do you remember about your last show?
It was in San Diego. That's about all. And I was sad. I was sad. Cause it's funny. I had just gone through this right before I sort of figured out what was happening. I had gone through this sort of feeling like I was going to, you know, double down on my commitment. I was going to finish school, and I was going to really try to find ways of being a contributing member. And what more could I do to help you know, with the day-to-day operation and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. It almost seems like being in Black Flag wasn't pleasant. So, and Black Flag wasn't making a lot of money. So there must have been some sort of like something that kept everyone going. Like you're fighting a war or something. I don't know. It just seems like a really dark vibe with that band.
Well, you know, most of us in the punk rock scene felt that, you know, the dark vibe was everywhere. You know, it was the 1980s. Ronald Reagan was president. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, you got to put yourself in the times. You know, it's a dark time. And, you know, my options are limited. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to finish school. I'm going to have this degree. And so joy, I can go get a straight job, you know, or right. What? Like, I mean, how am I going to make a living? I'm going to get a straight job, or, you know, this seemed like it was a way to make, you know, yeah, not a great living, but I might be able to bump along for a while, and maybe something more would happen with it. Maybe more money would come out of it, or maybe there'd be another band someday. But, you know, no, it's weird. Nobody ever offered me another big band contract.
Yeah. Well, but there is something interesting you do around this time is you start writing lyrics for the Minutemen. And then Firehose shortly after that. How did that come about?
Well, on the 85 tour, the first week, Minutemen were opening up for us. And I spent some time hanging out with Mike and getting to know him a little better. And I had always written poetry, you know, truth be told. It was just that nobody, including myself, was really driven to write music to that. And he expressed interest in it. So I sent him some poems and he turned them into songs. I mean, the effort and impetus was all on his end. You know, I just, I had always written poetry. He just actually liked what he read and decided to try to turn it into stuff, you know.
Right.
And it turned out he got emotionally invested, the silly man.
Oh, emotionally invested with you because you ended up marrying him, right?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I'm saying that if looking at that exact thing, if he and I had not gotten emotionally involved, he may never have written those songs to my lyrics, is what I'm saying.
Right.
That wasn't a artistic, inspirational thing, or was it in a way just another, you know, part of his wooing process? I don't know. I'm being silly, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's well, some of those complicated than just, you know, an artistic. Here, I think I love this poem so much, I'm going to write a song, because he wouldn't have done that to just anyone's poetry, right?
Well, one of these songs that you wrote, and I had no idea you wrote it, and I've been listening to this for like 25 years, is Relating Dudes to Jazz by Firehose. And it mentions New Haven, which is where, is that where you're from originally? Somewhere in Connecticut, right?
New Haven, yes.
So. Yeah. And then it talks about my compadre Raymond. Who's that? Raymond Pettibone?
Well, hold on. I think you're confusing what part I wrote in that song.
Oh, I thought you wrote all the lyrics too. I'm so sorry.
No, I didn't write any lyrics. I wrote the music as part of Dose, and he's crediting me because I was involved in the songwriting of the music, and he wrote the lyrics.
My bad.
Okay. No, I mean, I'm credited on it, which is, you know, not, it's, you know, I almost, in a weird way, I almost enjoy more that some of my music, you know, seeped its way into, you know, the Firehose legacy than lyrics, because I haven't written that in my life compared to some of these people who are so prolific. You know, I have written many fewer songs. So it's kind of fun to have my musical stylings, if you will, pop up in various places around.
Right. And then tell us about D. Boone and his relationship with Mike Watt. Because we're talking 85 here. I know they were like best friends in the world, or that's the impression I get.
Well, yeah, I mean, they kind of grew up together, you know, and their world, like many, you know, communities, it was sort of a small community that they grew up together in. They were both kind of outcasts, you know, not necessarily the popular kids, right? And music became a sort of way to find footing in this weird world they were in, you know? And so, yeah, they were best friends, but it was also became a very grown up sort of partnership, right? They became interdependent in order to, you know, make a living and stuff. I mean, you know, neither one of them were working straight jobs at the point when D. Boone died. Mike lost his art and his job, you know, and he lost his father not long after. So it was just a absolutely devastating time.
Right.
And Kira, Dose kind of starts out of the ashes of that situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was afraid he'd never play bass again, you know, honestly. And I had been doing these little bedtime stories with two bass lines because when I moved to Connecticut after college, because I didn't have a job or a band or anything, I got a job in Connecticut. I was afraid my nephews, who were very young, would forget me. So I would do these bedtime stories and overdub basses on them. So because I had all of this going on, I started just coming over to Mike's house with the bass and saying, let's noodle out around on this. We noodled around on a couple of those. We did some jams, you know, just trying to really come over and have him pick up the bass because he literally didn't want to do anything or go anywhere. He didn't attend any memorial, which is somewhat of a philosophy of his. He didn't go to any of the memorials of anyone that I know of. But anyway, at the time, it was just simply showing up with my bass and trying to get him to play, and not with the idea. I was actually kind of surprised that he suddenly was doing Firehose because it seemed like it was all going very slowly until Ed shows up from Ohio, and then suddenly it's like he's back in it. It was an interesting, you know, he actually, when I moved to Connecticut, he also started a band called Criminy with my brother, because it was like he was just trying to recreate this twosomes, and I wasn't handy. So not that they didn't do cool stuff, I'm just saying he was trying to find, you know, build things out of the ashes, like you said.
Yeah. Tell me if this is right, the whole Ed Crawford story. He's like the biggest Minutemen fan in the world. and D Boone is gone and he just decides I'm going to drive from Ohio to San Pedro, California and ring on Mike Watt's doorbell unannounced and decide, and just say, I'm going to start a band with you. Is that really how it went down?
Far as I know, I mean, that's the story that they tell. I wasn't there.
Okay. It just seems like, wow, that actually happened.
I mean, it happened very fast. And Mike certainly didn't go on a quest to find the right guitar player to start some band. So I do think that Ed was the impetus in terms of offering up the guitar player for this new trio.
Right.
Kira, so, how do you become a dialogue editor, and what does a dialogue editor do?
I was working in computers. I studied computers at school and eventually got a job as a computer programmer, basically. And I wasn't particularly happy working in the corporate world, although I was relatively successful at it. And then my brother was composing music for this student film for this guy who was at USC Film School, and they had me come in and record bass for it. And this guy was doing sound on this little student film. And so I got to know him, and I got to know this idea of, you know, doing quote unquote post-production sound on movies and stuff. So that was my first introduction to that. And I basically begged him to let me come work for his tiny little sound company, because I thought, you know, I have the computer skills, which is one side of it, and I have the musical ear, or, you know, I've had a good ear on the other side of it. This would be a good job for me. And I could get out of the rat race of working in the corporate world. And I took a huge cut in pay and went to work for the guy and started just answering phones and running errands and stuff. And then what I found out was that boys like to do sound effects and explosions and cars and guns and stuff, but dialogue tends to be a female heavy thing because it's particularly detail oriented and frustrating. And so the work in dialogue editing is basically like you are handed, if you think about how what they record on set, right? They record a bunch of different scenes and takes. And then what they do is they go into picture editorial and they chop them all up and create a scene or a TV show or whatever, right? They put together a scene with various scenes and takes. And it sounds like all these different little pieces that they plug together. So it's sort of Frankenstein together into a scene. And then what a dialogue editor does is it takes this, you know, sort of Frankenstein together scene and smooths it all out. And basically I think of it as solving however many millions of problems I can solve before I run out of time.
Right.
And if I have to, you know, I can record ADR to replace sort of unusable dialogue. I also record loop group, which is the people in the background who are not talking on set, right? They look like they're talking, but that's all recorded after the fact in the studio. So it's quite a bit of work, and it's a lot of like a puzzle trying to solve problems and find solutions to problems or suggest delicately to the director that it needs to be ADR'd, and most directors don't want to do that, but that's one way to solve the problem.
Yeah, and we should mention for the people listening that you did win a primetime Emmy for outstanding sound editing for a series, and that was for Game of Thrones in 2012.
I actually have two of those. I have one for John Adams, which is another HBO, a mini series.
How does that feel to get like an accolade like that?
It's pretty cool. You know, it's for the whole team. But, you know, you go up on the stage and they announce the team and the supervisor takes the award and stands there. And then you go back and they hand everybody an award, you know, it was pretty amazing the first time because I didn't know that everyone would get one, you know. Whereas in Oscars, if you're on a team with the Oscars, only the supervisor gets one. Because I have been on part of a team, but only the supervisors got the hardware, you know, so I just got thanked. But so it feels great, you know. I mean, those award shows are the award programs and the dinners associated and stuff are nightmares. They're ridiculously long and just like you'd expect these award things to be, you know, way too long and, you know, too much time of not fun things happening, but going home with the hardware is a really fun part of the evening.
What was the Oscar for?
Oh, it was a Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's insane.
Great experience. I went to Sydney for 6 weeks, came home for two, went back for six to work with the director on dialogue and mostly ADR on that. So it was a ton of work. It was really challenging, but really proud of it too.
Yeah. I saw that you did the audio for Shark Attack 2. Did you ever see Shark Attack 3? Cause that's a crazy one. The Megalodon.
Dude, I worked on so many back in the day, and not everybody remembers this, but when Blockbuster Video was a thing, right? There were all these ones where there was just one video, like Shark Attack 2, right? Like the big movies would have like a whole wall of them so that everybody could rent one. But the little movies, the little independent ones, there'd be like one copy. And when I first started, you know, those were the movies that I was working on. So, you know, it's kind of amazing now to be working on movies that, I mean, we were nominated for Joker for Academy Award too, you know, so it's kind of amazing to actually work on teams where, you know, you're on the wall of the Blockbuster Video, not just the single one.
That's super cool. Ben, do you have anything else?
I wanted to ask about Uni High. You went there freshman, sophomore.
No, it's just 10th grade. You're just 10th grade. So my brother, like I said, went there ahead of me with Darby and Pat, and then I was still in junior high at that time. And then I went to 10th grade there before we moved to Van Nuys in the Valley, which is when punk rock was really getting going, was when I got in 11th grade and we were in the Valley because we could have a house with a garage and have band practice and all of that. But in uni high, there was this special school called IPS, where they had like TM teachers, like transcendental meditation teachers, and you could get, it was like a school within a school. It was all very foo-foo and meditation, and, you know, phys ed was like Tai Chi.
And that was Pat and Darby and your brother?
Well, no, they did it ahead of me, but I also went to this.
Right. Oh, okay.
Within a school at 10th grade. It was just not the same time as them. So, you know, it was a West Side. You have to understand it's sort of the geography of LA, right? The West Side is sort of the more upper crust of it all. And they have, you know, things like that school within a school, the sort of nowadays, I guess those people would go to private school. I don't know. But at that time, those were the, you know, those were the fancy pants elements within the school. And, you know, then I go to Van Nuys and it's like, they don't have an Algebra 2 teacher. You know?
Wow. Because I know Wasted Youth went to Uni High, but that I think might have been a little bit after you. graduate.
Yeah, probably. Everybody was after me.
Well, but I read
the old part. Which is funny because really not. When I first was in punk rock, there were a bunch of old fuddy-duddies in it. So it's like I'm not part of the really first wave when it comes to the age. I was one of the young kids. But the Wasted Youth kids were part of the second wave of punk rock. So they were kids then. So it makes sense that they would be.
Yeah, totally.
And when I say second wave, I just mean like 3 years later. I don't mean like a generation or anything.
Well, in punk rock time, 3 years is a generation.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much for you know, letting us ask you all these inane questions about university, high school, and Black Flag and all that.
No problem.
Yeah, Kira, you've been so generous with your time. It is much appreciated. Do you feel like you've been well represented on this?
I guess I just want to be fully complete. We have to at least say something about the band I was in for 30 years.
All right, let's do it.
My band with Mike Watt, which has several records out, and is just, I've learned, and the reason I bring it up is just because my bass playing and who I am as a bass player and a songwriter has been so greatly influenced by the difficulties and challenges of writing for a two bass band and playing with another bass player and figuring out how to intertwine two basses and make it not even so much make it interesting, but like learn how to leave holes for each other and learn how to not just, you know, play all on top of each other and stuff. It's just made me so much better bass player. Now when I sit down and sometimes I just write a bass line for someone, like it, doing like a virtual band, they'll send me a song and say, will you play bass on this? Well, I've learned so much about how to do something just a little more interesting because I'm not just playing the obvious rock bass line. And that's all because of Doze. And it's all because of Mike Watt and me doing what I call bass wars. So I just want to shout out to Doze and to Mike. And I also have my other two bass band, Awkward, with Devin Hoff, who is a stand-up bass player. And we also do bass wars. And we have a band camp page. So if you ever want to check out Awkward, we're doing some more stuff. And it's just another, like you said, straight rock is all fine and dandy, but find a way to do something that's off the beaten path. This, I think Doze is very punk rock because there's nothing like it. And in that way, that's what I've been challenging myself, is find new ways of doing new music. I don't believe that the only good music is old music. There's new music happening all the time. That's probably really cool. You just haven't gone out and found it.
All right. Well, we'll be sure to link up Awkward in the show notes so everyone can check it out. Check out the Bandcamp. And yeah, Kira, thanks so much. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. And thanks, Ben. And thanks, Zach. And thanks for having me. And go team.